the Battle of Kurukshetra has ended, and Bhishma Dev has departed from this world by his own will and by his own power. He's given us many glimpses into the character and consciousness of a pure devotee, as well as we've understood some amazing points about Krishna himself. Such as what? I mean, actually amazing, not mildly amazing. What did we learn from Bhishma Dev that's actually amazing about Krishna? Yeah, I have to admit that is amazing. But even still more amazing than his all-powerfulness. Yeah. But it's not that one is actually an enemy of the Lord. He's a glorious devotee, but his mood in relating with Krishna is that of an enemy. And he is doing what? He's shooting arrows at Krishna. And Krishna is accepting those arrows because Bhishma Dev is a warrior. But not a warrior who's against Krishna. He is a warrior. And his relationship with Krishna is fighting with Krishna and shooting arrows at Krishna and appreciating how Krishna is driving Arjuna's chariot and protecting Arjuna and not leaving Arjuna. Because just like if there is an expert, really expert kirtan singer, and when if I hear someone singing kirtan, he's very good. But I don't really have the finer discriminations. But Bhishma Dev was a warrior, and certain things that he appreciated in the character of Krishna, how Krishna would not leave Arjuna despite the fact that his body was pierced, and that itself is amazing. Krishna's transcendental body is unpierceable, but yet it was pierced and bleeding? How is that? How is that possible? It isn't possible. But it happened. Why? Huh? Yes, but even more than that. It was an illusion, yes. Because Bhishma Dev was fighting Krishna. And what's the use of fighting Superman? What's the use of fighting God if your mood is devotional? What's the use? He can't lose. But to reciprocate the rasa, Krishna is manifesting wounds and blood. A specific illusion created by the internal energy for the pleasure of Krishna's devotee. And how Krishna is rushing towards Bhishma angrily. And Arjuna is pulling Krishna back. Why? Why? His vow, yes. That he wouldn't participate. But Krishna has another vow that he values more than anything else. And that vow is to? Yes. No. But his vow, Krishna's most dearest vow, is to protect his devotee. Maybe that's in the Swiss version of the Mahabharata. Just like in Sri Lanka, they have a different version of the Ramayana where Ravana wins. And but yet, this Bhishma Dev then left this world with Krishna standing right before him with his consciousness focused fully upon Krishna. And then Yudhisthira and the others, Krishna, they went to Hastinapur. and Yudhisthira began ruling. The first part of this 10th chapter, the first 6 verses, speak about the rule of Yudhisthira. Because Yudhisthira started ruling, and Shonaka Rishi asked, basically, what happened next? Yudhisthira started ruling well. What was his kingdom like? So Shonaka Rishi asks, after killing his enemies who desired to usurp his rightful inheritance, how did the greatest of all religious men, Maharaj Yudhisthira, assisted by his brothers, rule his subjects? Surely he could not freely enjoy his kingdom with unrestricted consciousness. Prabhupada's purport. Maharaj Yudhisthira was the greatest of all men of religion. Thus he was not at all inclined to fight with his cousins for the sake of enjoying the kingdom. He fought for the right cause because the kingdom of Hastinapur was his rightful inheritance and his cousins wanted to usurp it for themselves. They were so intent, the Pandavas were so intent on compromise. Somehow we'll work it out. At least give us 5 villages. They were warriors. They were rulers. They could not get a job, become IT programmers or something like that. Rather, they had to rule. So give us at least 5 villages, one for each of us to rule. And what was Duryodhana's response? I cannot even spare enough land to drive a pin through, a needle through. Just dismiss them. Therefore, war. Because this was ultimately Krishna's desire. Because Krishna wanted to establish Yudhisthira as the king, the proper member of the Kuru dynasty. So he fought, therefore, for the right cause under the guidance of Lord Sri Krishna. But he could not enjoy the results of his victory because his cousins were all killed in the fight. He therefore ruled over the kingdom as a matter of duty, assisted by his younger brothers. The inquiry was important for Shonaka Rishi, who wanted to know about the behavior of Maharaj Yudhisthira when he was at ease to enjoy the kingdom. Just like Prabhupada worked so hard, he came to the United States in what year? 65. And he worked so hard to establish the Krishna Consciousness Movement. So after the Krishna Consciousness Movement was established, say by 1975, well, how did Prabhupada act then? Did he relax, sit back? When Prabhupada first came to the United States, he had maybe 30, 40 rupees, plus some books. And then by 1975, 1976, Prabhupada had maybe $20 million, maybe more, worth of properties and things like that. So how did Prabhupada act when everything was established, when he was a wealthy man? Did he sit back and enjoy his kingdom of the devotees? Not at all. He preached, he got stronger in his preaching. He kept traveling. He worked on his projects that he specifically was taking responsibility for, such as Bombay, Vrindavan, Mayapur. He worked so hard. It's an interesting question to analyze after the movement was established, what happened with Prabhupada. So Yudhisthira had fought to establish his kingdom, and then he got the kingdom. Well, what did he do? Did he sit back to enjoy it? That was the question of Shonaka Rishi. Certainly he couldn't do that. And yes, he was so righteous after his cousins were killed. How could he do that? So Sutta Goswami said, Lord Sri Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is the maintainer of the world, became pleased after re-establishing Maharaj Yudhisthira in his own kingdom and after restoring the Kuru dynasty, because he was the rightful heir to the Kuru dynasty, which had been exhausted by the Kuru dynasty, which had been exhausted by the bamboo fire of anger. So what causes a bamboo fire? Just the wind. There is no human cause, just the wind, or you could say providence, or providence really ultimately means Krishna. The world, Prabhupada's purport explains, is compared to a forest fire caused by the cohesion of bamboo bushes. Such a forest fire takes place automatically, for bamboo cohesion occurs without external cause. Similarly, in the material world, the wrath of those who want to lord it over material nature interacts, and the fire of war takes place, exhausting the unwanted population. Such fires or wars take place, and the Lord has nothing to do with them. If we look at Kunti's prayers, 18:28, perhaps someone could read that in the previous chapter. Excuse me, 28. Someone could read that loudly. 8:28. Yes. It has to be really loud, though.
My Lord, tell your lordship to be eternal life, supreme control, without beginning mercy, but equal to everyone, especially with living beings, where in the course.
Yes. So Krishna, although he's the cause of all causes, is not actually the cause of the dissension between different personalities. This is just due to the reactions of the different karma of the individuals. So he doesn't actually cause it, although ultimately everything is happening under his direction. Maya dakshena prakriti suyate sucharacharan. But Prabhupada continues, because he wants to maintain the creation, he desires the mass of people to follow the right path of self-realization, which enables the living beings to enter into the kingdom of God. So Krishna, as it explains right at the end of this purport, was fully satisfied when King Yudhisthira was on the throne and the seedling of the dynasty of Kuru in the person of Maharaj Prickett was saved. So Krishna did both those things. Now, what was the kingdom like of Yudhisthira? Maharaj Yudhisthira, after being enlightened by what was spoken by Bhishma Dev and Lord Sri Krishna, the infallible, engaged himself in matters of perfect knowledge because all his misgivings were eradicated. Thus he ruled over the earth and seas and was followed by his younger brothers. During the reign of Maharaj Yudhisthira, the clouds showered all the water that people needed, and the earth produced all the necessities of man in profusion. Due to its fatty milk bags and cheerful attitude, the cow used to moisten the grazing ground with milk. Sometimes Prabhupada, I'll read the remaining verses in this section. The rivers, oceans, hills, mountains, forests, creepers, and active drugs in every season paid their tax quota to the king in profusion. Because of the kings having no enemy, the living beings were not at any time disturbed by mental agonies, diseases, or excessive heat or cold. Sometimes Prabhupada, in his purports, when describing a reign of a king who is ruling according to Krishna's desire, that his will is one with Krishna's, and then he's actually what's the name of a king? Naradev. Yes, he's actually not an ordinary person. In Western civilization, or Prabhupada would never give it the grace of calling it Western civilization, but so-called civilization, the power and potency of the different leaders of society are removed. Actually, the king is empowered. The ruler is empowered. There's a certain potency that comes to a ruler. And everyone knows this, really. Everyone is wishing, hoping the ruler to be more than he is. But actually, when done properly, the ruler carries a potency of God. And the parents, mother and father, they also carry a potency of God. But in Kali Yuga, everything is removed, and therefore people grow up very wounded in their lives and somewhat disturbed always, and never can be peaceful, never can be happy, because everything is unnatural. The parents aren't taken seriously. The king or ruler is laughed at and not taken seriously, divested of his position due to his not being actually qualified. So Prabhupada has a way in his purports of very heavily condemning contemporary civilizations by comparing them, by exposing them for what they are. In text 4, he says, sort of a third of the way or a quarter of the way down the first paragraph, grains and vegetables can sumptuously feed a man and animals. And a fatty cow delivers enough milk to supply a man sumptuously with vigor and vitality. If there is enough milk, enough grains, enough fruit, enough cotton, enough silk, and enough jewels, then why do the people need cinemas, houses of prostitution, slaughterhouses, etc.? What is the need of an artificial luxurious life of cinema, cars, radio, flesh, and hotels? Has this civilization produced anything but quarreling individually and nationally? Has this civilization enhanced the cause of equality and fraternity by sending thousands of men into a hellish factory and the war fields at the whims of a particular man? It is said here that the cows used to moisten the pasturing land with milk because their milk bags were fatty and the animals were joyful. Do they not require, therefore, proper protection for a joyful life by being fed with a sufficient quantity of grass in the field? Why should men kill cows for their selfish purposes? Why should man not be satisfied with grains, fruits, and milk, which, combined together, can produce hundreds and thousands of palatable dishes? Why are there slaughterhouses all over the world to kill innocent animals? Well said. Why? So hard-hearted and cruel and callous people have become. It is not required. And yet it is done. And the Christians say, well, God gave man dominion over the earth and all the creatures on it. Well, if you have dominion over someone, does that mean that you kill them and eat them? The father has dominion over his family. Does that mean that he can kill them and eat them and cause them pain when it is not necessary? Such a cruel, animalistic society. And Prabhupada's purport to 5, we'll read from the beginning a little of that. Since Maharaj Yudhisthira was under the protection of the Ajita, the infallible Lord, as above mentioned, the properties of the Lord, namely the rivers, oceans, hills, forests, etc., were all pleased, and they used to supply their respective quarter of taxes to the king. The secret to success is to take refuge under the protection of the Supreme Lord. Without his sanction, nothing can be possible. To make economic development by our own endeavors on the strength of tools and machinery is not all. The sanction of the Supreme Lord must be there. Otherwise, despite all instrumental arrangements, everything will be unsuccessful. The ultimate cause of success is the Daiva, the Supreme. So nowadays, everyone thinks everything depends on them and their own power. And therefore, everyone is miserable because one's own potencies aren't enough to make one happy. So what does the devotee do? He depends on Krishna and takes shelter of Krishna's power and Krishna's potencies. And then, by Krishna's potencies, he becomes happy and successful. And the beginning of six, purport of six. To be non-violent to human beings and to be a killer or enemy of the poor animals is Satan's philosophy. It is born of the devil. In this age, there is enmity towards poor animals, and therefore the poor creatures are always anxious. The reaction of the poor animals is being forced on human society, and therefore there is always the strain of cold or hot war between men, individually, collectively, or nationally. Just some little excerpts of Prabhupada's analysis of the fallen condition of Kali Yuga civilizations, which caused so much difficulty, although there is always promise of hope and happiness later. But now, Sutta is continuing. Sri Hari, Lord Sri Krishna, resided at Hastinapur for a few months to pacify his relatives and to please his own sister, Subhadra, whose only son, Abhimanyu, was killed in the battle. Afterwards, when the Lord asked permission to depart, and the king gave it, the Lord offered his respects to Maharaj Yudhisthira by bowing down at his feet, and the king embraced him. So now Krishna is actually going to leave for Dwarka. Yudhisthira Maharaj was asked permission, he granted it, and Krishna, being younger, junior, he bowed down. After this, the Lord, being embraced by others and receiving their obeisances, got into his chariot. So amazing, amongst all the other amazing things, that Krishna, playing the part of Maharaj Yudhisthira's younger cousin, bows down, although he's the Supreme Lord. But the pastime goes on. At that time, Subhadra, Draupadi, Kunti, Uttara, Gandhari, Dhritarashtra, Yutsu, Kripacharya, Nakul, Sahadev, Bhimasen, Domya, Satyavati, all nearly fainted because it was impossible for them to bear separation from Lord Krishna. So we've been hearing what it is like to relate to Lord Krishna, to have one's relationship opened, and how Krishna cares for his devotees. How Krishna is so wonderful, will accept whatever the devotee offers as long as it's offered with devotion. And how he steals the hearts of all the devotees. That's what it means to be a devotee, to have a heart stolen by Krishna. But then Krishna leaves. And then what happens? The verse explains all these personalities who all loved Krishna, they nearly fainted because it was impossible for them to bear separation from Lord Krishna. So that Lord, who we are so far away from, we don't even notice. It's not difficult for us. So what we are missing, it's not difficult for us to be apart from Krishna. But what are we missing? We get a hint in the verse in Prabhupada's purport. Lord Sri Krishna is so attractive for the living beings, especially for the devotees, that it is impossible for them to tolerate separation. The conditioned souls under the spell of illusory energy forgets the Lord, otherwise he cannot. The feeling of such separation cannot be described. But it can simply be imagined by devotees only. Just imagine what it was like for the residents of Vrindavan, for the residents of Hastinapur, how much they loved Krishna, and how much when Krishna was absent from them, their hearts were breaking and they were constantly thinking only of Krishna in great, great love. Just imagine. This is proper use of the imagination. After his separation from Vrindavan and the innocent rural cowherd boys, girls, ladies, and others, they all felt shock throughout their lives. And the separation of Radharani, the most beloved cowherd girl, is beyond expression. Once they met at Kurukshetra during a solar eclipse, and the feeling which was expressed by them is heartrending. There is, of course, a difference in the qualities of the transcendental devotees of the Lord, but none of them who have ever contacted the Lord by direct communion or otherwise can leave him for a moment. That is the attitude of the pure devotee. So we've heard about different kinds of devotees. We've heard how Arjuna is relating with Krishna and how he deals. Who came next after Arjuna? The other Pandavas, including Draupadi, Bhimasena, and Krishna manifested forearms. Then who else? Who is next? Before Kunti. Uttara, how Krishna protected her, then Kunti Devi, and in Kunti Devi's prayers, we heard of her relating with the others, and she even glorified Mother Yasoda in that. And then next was, after Kunti, Yudhisthira Maharaj, actually, and then Bhishma. And in Bhishma's prayers, he mentioned Krishna as Parthasarathi. And he also mentioned the gopis. So there's different ways of relating with Krishna, but yet there are common things in all those ways. There are common points. And the most common is the love the devotees feel for Krishna. And they always want to be with him. Sometimes we hear that separation is higher than meeting Krishna. And yes, it's true, but do you think that the devotees who are experiencing separation are thinking, oh, it's so wonderful to be separated from Krishna? This is the highest? This is great? No, what are they thinking? I can't tolerate, I'm going to faint, I'm going to die. Srimati Radharani was practically dead continuously. Separate from Krishna in the intensity. So in that sense, the purpose of the separation, or that which fuels the separation, is only meeting. Separation doesn't exist by itself. It is not an end of itself, but the intense desire has to be meeting, to be with Krishna, to want to be with Krishna, for there to be any separation at all experiences separation. If one doesn't care, if one's happy to be separated, then there's no feeling of separation. That's why we're in the material world. We're separate from Krishna, but with no feelings of separation, because we have no desire to meet him. But soon as that desire to meet Krishna starts to burn in our heart, then we will advance and advance and advance. We have to become attracted to Krishna. So there's a verse that describes this. We've been hearing the story, but the next verse says, the intelligent who have understood the Supreme Lord in association with pure devotees and have become freed from bad materialistic association can never avoid hearing the glories of the Lord, even though they have heard them only once. So this is a comparison. If those who have actually touched Krishna through hearing about him, even once from a pure devotee, can't avoid hearing about him anymore, because they're so attracted to Krishna, the taste, the flavor of associating with Krishna in that way. Then, so it's an if-then, if that is true, then how could the Pandavas tolerate his separation? For they had been intimately associated with his person, seeing him face to face, touching him, conversing with him, and sleeping, sitting, and dining with him. So they were so intimate. The love that they experienced with Krishna was so great due to the intimacy of the dealings, that when Krishna was leaving, it was like their life was leaving the body. Now, there's a point that comes up in my mind gradually, and it'll be answered here, but it'll also be spoken of more directly a little bit later. That we hear about Krishna and his dealings with the Pandavas, that's what we're hearing about now, and how all the devotees were associating with Krishna, exchanging with him. So naturally, they had so much love for him because they were practically speaking dealing with him. But here we are. Of course, right now we're in Sri Vrindavan Dham. But say, here we are, and we're in so many places all over the world, and Krishna is not with us. So how is it possible, even though we hear something about Krishna, and it comes in our heart, yes, I would like to develop my relationship with Krishna. I would like this to awaken within me. I want this to start burning, but I'm so far away. He's not here. If he was here, then it would be easy, but he's not here. So what to do? So this, we'll read a little of Prabhupada, and there's a hint in the verse of what to do exactly. And in Prabhupada's purport in the second half, it will explain it as well, and then it will be spoken of a little more directly later on. Because this is what the Bhagavatam is all about. What to do after Krishna has left the planet, taking with him Dharma Gyanadevi Saha Kalo Nasta Drishamesha, and a great darkness descends in Kali Yuga, and it gives us so many other things to do instead of developing love of Krishna. So many enjoyments, so much glitter is poured on mundane things that bring no happiness, that we can't help but be attracted, practically speaking. But yet the Bhagavatam comes like the sun, Puranako Dunodita, to give us the association of Krishna. And he comes as the holy names to give us his association. So Prabhupada's purport. By associating with pure devotees and by hearing them submissively, attachment for material enjoyment becomes slackened, and attraction for hearing about the transcendental activities of the Lord becomes prominent. Once they are what? Once they are prominent, once they become to gain more of a dominance in our consciousness, they will go on progressively without stoppage, like fire in gunpowder. What an example. It is said that Hari, the personality of Godhead, is so transcendentally attractive that even those who are self-satisfied by self-realization and are factually liberated from all material bondage also become devotees of the Lord. Under the circumstances, it is easily understood what must have been the position of the Pandavas, who were constant companions of the Lord. They could not even think of separation from Sri Krishna, since the attraction was more intense for them because of continuous personal contact. His remembrance by his form, quality, name, fame, pastimes, etc., is also attractive for the pure devotee, so much so that he, the pure devotee, forgets all forms, quality, name, fame, and activities of the mundane world. And due to his mature association with pure devotees, he is not out of contact with the Lord for a moment. So the Lord's association is in fact available. So the Pandavas, describing the Pandavas and the residents of Hastinapur, all their hearts were melting for him on the pot of attraction. They looked at him without blinking their eyes, and they moved hither and thither in perplexity. There is a short comment by Srila Srila Swami on text 13 here. He describes the meaning of the word tatra tatra vichalas. Yes, tatra tatra vichalas, tatra tatra. Began to move here and there. As the Pandavas remained unable to leave the Lord for a moment, they followed Krishna everywhere and went everywhere with him. They just stayed with him. They couldn't do anything else due to their attraction. Prabhupada's purport. Krishna is naturally attractive for all living beings because he's the chief eternal amongst eternals. He alone is the maintainer of the many eternals. That's us. What's the verse? This is stated in the Katha Upanishad, and thus one can obtain permanent peace and prosperity by revival of one's eternal relationship with him, now forgotten under the spell of Maya, the illusory energy of the Lord. Once this relation is slightly revived, the conditioned soul at once becomes freed from the illusion of material energy and becomes mad after the association of the Lord. This association is made possible not only by personal contact with the Lord, which is the point that I was inquiring about just a few moments before, but because that's the thing, the Pandavas couldn't tolerate the separation from the Lord because of their constant association with the Lord. So how to constantly associate with the Lord when he's not present? But it's made possible not only by personal contact with the Lord, Srila Prabhupada says, but also by association with his name, fame, form, and quality. Srimad Bhagavatam trains the conditioned soul to the stage of perfection by submissive hearing from the pure devotee. So therefore, Prabhupada put so much emphasis in his own life on translating the Bhagavatam to give us his association and also the association of the acharyas in his translation and in his Bhaktivedanta purports. The female relatives, whose eyes were flooded with tears out of anxiety for Krishna, came out of the palace. They could stop their tears only with great difficulty. They feared that tears would cause misfortune at the time of departure. So they were trying not to cry, even though it was their feminine nature to cry, but they didn't want an auspicious scene at the time to cause inauspiciousness, because in culture, in a cultured place, in Bengal, for instance, they never say goodbye when someone is leaving. They don't say goodbye, they say Ami Asi, which means I'm coming. Because going is inauspicious, but I'm just coming, don't worry. So they don't want any misfortune and inauspiciousness to come for Krishna. Prabhupada's purport. We'll just read a little bit at the end. And because it's Prabhupada makes the same point again about how we can associate with Krishna now, although he has already left this world. Directly or indirectly, because he's talking about the ladies who never came in direct contact with Krishna, but they also developed great affection for Krishna. So therefore, directly or indirectly, anyone who thinks of Krishna, talks of Krishna, or worships Krishna becomes attached to him. Because Krishna is absolute, there is no difference between his name, form, quality, etc. Our intimate relation with Krishna can be confidentially revived by our talking of, hearing of, or remembering him. It is so done due to spiritual potency. While the Lord was departing from the palace of Hastinapur, different types of drums like the madanga, dol, nagra, dunduri, and dundubi, and flutes of different types, veena, gomuk, and bedi, all sounded together to show him honor. Out of loving desire to see the Lord, the royal ladies of the Kurus got on top of the palace, and smiling with affection and shyness, they showered flowers upon the Lord. We'll read from the second purport. Prabhupada speaks about the dealings between men and women. Human civilization, as conceived of by the sages of India, is to help one free himself from the clutches of illusion. The material beauty of a woman is an illusion because, actually, the body is made of earth, water, fire, air, etc. But because there is the association of the living spark with matter, it appears to be beautiful. No one is attracted by an earthen doll, even if it is most perfectly prepared to attract the attention of others. The dead body has no beauty because no one will accept the dead body of a so-called beautiful woman. Therefore, the conclusion is that the spiritual spark is beautiful, and because of the soul's beauty, one is attracted by the beauty of the outward body. The Vedic wisdom, therefore, forbids us to be attracted by false beauty. But because we are now in the darkness of ignorance, the Vedic civilization allows very restricted mixing of woman and man. They say that the woman is considered to be the fire and the man is considered to be the butter. The butter must melt in association with fire, and therefore they may be brought together only when it is necessary, and shyness is a check to the unrestricted mixing. It is nature's gift, and it must be utilized. So the ladies of Hastinapur went to the roofs and they showered flowers down upon Krishna. And at that time, Arjuna, the great warrior and conqueror of sleep, who is the intimate friend of the most beloved Supreme Lord, took up an umbrella which had a handle of jewels and was embroidered with lace and pearls. Uddhava and Satyaki began to fan the Lord with decorated fans, and everyone was just going with him wherever he went. And the Lord is the master of Madhu. There's that Madhupati again. The master of Madhu, Krishna. Seated on scattered flowers, commanded them along the road. It was being heard in and here and there that the benedictions being paid to Krishna were neither befitting nor unbefitting, because they were all for the Absolute, who is now playing the part of a human being. Absorbed in the thought of the transcendental qualities of the Lord, who is sung in selected poetry, the ladies on the roofs of all the houses of Hastinapur began to talk of him. This talk was more attractive than the hymns of the Vedas. It was attractive because it had to do with Krishna directly, describing him as he walked down the road, or he was seated rather. And the Vedas only describe Krishna indirectly. So this is what the ladies said. And these verses, there are 10 verses here, 21 through 30. And they are very wonderful. And in a sense, they're very simple. The first three have to do with the creation, how Krishna is the source of the creation. And we won't read those purports because we're going to hear plenty of the creation in the second canto. So if anyone misses anything, we'll hear plenty of it then, and the third canto too. But yet, they're explaining how the Lord existed before the creation, and everything merges within him at the time of annihilation. But I'll read these three verses, then we'll speak a little bit about them. So the ladies on top of the buildings, they said, here he is, the original personality of Godhead, as we definitely remember him. He alone existed before the manifested creation of the modes of nature. And in him only, because he is the Supreme Lord, all living beings merge as if sleeping at night, their energy suspended. The personality of Godhead, again desiring to give names and forms to his parts and parcels, the living entities, placed them under the guidance of material nature. By his own potency, material nature is empowered to recreate. But here is the same Supreme Personality of Godhead, whose transcendental form is experienced by the great devotees who are completely cleansed of material consciousness by dint of rigid devotional service and full control of life and senses. And that is the only way to purify existence. So the ladies are amazed, naturally, that they're seeing Krishna in front of him. He exists before the creation, before matter was created, he existed. So therefore it is impossible for his body to be made of matter, because matter didn't exist until he created it. So his body is spiritual, and there he is. And they're looking at him, the source of the creation, the one within whom all the living entities and all the material nature rests during the time of the creation. And there he is on the chariot. And then he desires to create again the material nature. So he places the living entities again in the material nature through his glance. But this Lord, who purified, incredibly purified great souls, they see him by dint of rigid devotional service, by rigid practices. They're able to see, they're completely purified, and therefore they're able to see him. And we are seeing this Lord right now, from the top of these buildings. I have one short quotation to offer you in this regard. A comment by Srila Sridhar Swami saying that the Lord is not easily seen by mankind. The bhakti process of seeing the Lord and advancing in devotional service is to fully engage all the senses in the Lord's service, which is the only way to control and purify the senses. And then Sridhar Swami says, because that may be a long process, while one is being purified, the Lord personally protects his devotees. So it is not only that the Lord protects those who are the most exalted of Paramhamsas, but those who have taken up the process, who are devotees of devotees, servants of servants, as they are getting purified, the Lord also protects them. And that they have to be assured of. They continue. Oh, dear friends, they're talking to each other. Here is that very personality of Godhead, whose attractive and confidential pastimes are described in the confidential parts of Vedic literatures by his great devotees. And we are going to hear those later, all throughout the Bhagavatam. We will hear those, but especially in Canto 10. It is he only who creates, maintains, and annihilates the material world, and yet he remains ineffective. So he is doing everything. He's unaffected. Before they were talking about he is created. Everything is coming from him. So hard to see him. And he's completely unaffected, aloof from everything. And yet he descends. The creator descends to this world. And actually all his pastimes, everything he does is completely confidential and very secret because there is nothing forcing him to do it. Everything is motivated by his own will, his own desire. So we can learn of his desires by watching his pastimes. We learn of what he's like, what he's desiring. That's like in the world. So many people do so many things, but how many people do only what they desire? So they're forced and forced and forced to do this and do that and do that. Because everyone's being forced, no one practically speaking, except at the rare moment, they can just do what they want to do. And everyone is looking for that time where I can just do what I want to do. But Krishna is only doing what he wants to do. So when we watch him, observe his pastimes, we find out what he's like. So the queens, or the ladies on the roofs, they're saying that he's going to show his confidential pastimes. Have a reference. Just the reference says that he's the Supreme Lord with different quotes. And there he is. We can see him. Now, why does Krishna come? What are his activities when he comes? This verse, text 25, very much explains things the way that the Bhagavad Gita explains them. Yada yada hidamasya glanir more. So the verse explains why he comes. Whenever there are kings and administrators living like animals in the lowest modes of existence, the Lord in his transcendental form manifests his supreme power. The truth positive shows special mercy to the faithful, performs wonderful activities, and manifests various transcendental forms as it is necessary in different periods and ages. In the last paragraph of Prabhupada's purport to 25. When he descends, he exhibits superhuman acts just to prove his supreme right, and materials like Ravan, Hiranyakashipu, and Kamsa are sufficiently punished. He acts in a manner which no one can imitate. For example, the Lord, when he appeared as Ram, bridged the Indian Ocean. When he appeared as Krishna, from his very childhood, he showed superhuman activities by killing Putana, Agasura, Shakatashura, Kali, etc. And then his maternal uncle Kamsa. When he was at Dwarka, he married 16,108 queens, and all of them were blessed with a sufficient number of children. The sum total of his personal family members amounted to about 100,000, popularly known as the Yaruvanks. And again, during his lifetime, he managed to vanquish them all. He is famous as Govardhana Darihari because he lifted at the age of only 7 the hill known as Govardhan. The Lord killed many undesirable kings in his time, and as a Kshatriya, he fought chivalrously. He is famous as Asama Udha, unparalleled. No one is equal or greater than him. So they continue. But this Lord descends and he performs these activities of yada yada hidamasya. But yet it's going to get to the point where he describes still more wonderful activities. Oh, they say, how supremely glorified is the dynasty of King Yadu, and how virtuous is the land of Mathura, where the supreme leader of all living beings, the husband of the goddess of fortune, has taken his birth and wandered in his childhood. Undoubtedly, it is wonderful that Dwarka has defeated the glories of the heavenly planets. So the Yadu dynasty is glorious, Mathura is glorious, and Dwarka is glorious. Now they are thinking Dwarka is most glorious, most fortunate. Why? He's just going there. And they're thinking themselves so unfortunate because Krishna is leaving. So how wonderful is that Dwarka? It has defeated the glories of the heavenly planets and has enhanced the celebrity of the earth. The inhabitants of Dwarka are always seeing the soul of all living beings, Krishna, in his loving feature. Because that's why Dwarka is glorious. And that's why the people there are so fortunate, because they're seeing Krishna. And Krishna is leaving us now. He glances at them and favors them with sweet smiles. And we are now losing that fortune. We'll read from some of Prabhupada's purport. The heavenly planets, this is about a quarter of the way. The heavenly planets are more celebrated than the earth, but the celebrity of earth has defeated that of the heavenly planets because of Dwarka, where Lord Sri Krishna reigned as king. Three places, namely Vrindavan, Mathura, and Dwarka, are more important than the famous planets within the universe. These places are perpetually sanctified because whenever the Lord descended on earth, he displays his transcendental activities, particularly in these three places. They're perpetually the holy lands of the Lord. And the inhabitants still take advantage of the holy places, even though the Lord is now out of their sight. The Lord is the soul of all living beings, and he desires always to have all the living beings in their swarupa, in their constitutional position, to participate in transcendental life in his association. His attractive features and sweet smiles go deep into the heart of everyone, and once it is so done, the living being is admitted into the kingdom of God, from which no one returns. So, what is so done? What is it that is so done that it brings one to the kingdom of God? Yes. Would anyone like to say anything about that? That's interesting. Yes, so is it only that Krishna's smile goes into the heart? No. But if we become pierced to the heart by Krishna in any of his aspects, because obviously it's not only the smile and not the lotus feet or his eyes or his beautiful hair or something. No. If we become pierced, touched to the core of our heart by Krishna in any way, but to the core of the heart, not superficially, if our heart deeply becomes touched, then we will go back to Godhead. Pierced to the core. Prabhupada explains at the end of the purport. Any person engaged in the devotional service of the Lord, and I'm going to ask for comments at the end of this, is recommended to live in one of the above mentioned three places, namely Dwarka, Mathura, or Vrindavan. Why? Because devotional service in these three places is magnified. Those who go there to follow the principles and terms of instructions imparted in the revealed scriptures surely achieve the same result as obtained during the presence of Lord Sri Krishna. His abode and he himself are identical, and a pure devotee under the guidance of another experienced devotee can obtain all the results even at present. Any comments? No one has any comment? That's interesting. What question comes? Yeah. Say again, please. Yes. Okay, that's on one side. We can say that every temple is a holy dham, and certainly it is true. Is there anything on the other side? Is Vrindavan Mayapur special? Everyone knows there's something special. Yes? Yes, certainly. How much we are able to carry that with us. Yes, anything else on this? Should everyone in ISKCON move to Vrindavan and Mayapur? You're going to say yes, I know. I'm not sure I'm going to call on you yet. Yes, Mayapur and Puri and Dwarka, yes. Yes, it is special. Prabhupada even said in the Krishna book, it said that even when a non-devotee comes to Vrindavan, he will feel separation from Krishna. Yes, careful especially in Vrindavan of offenses. But we see another example of Prabhupada leaving Vrindavan. Prabhupada called the temples sometimes embassies. That's a nice and simple way to understand it. So you could, like there's a, if you go to Perth even, you'll find an Indian embassy there. So actually the laws of the particular country that the embassy is in, they don't actually apply in that embassy because it's thought of as part of the country. But yet, it's not really the country, but on another way to looking at it is the country. So in the same way, the temples are none different. But should everyone only come? But yet Prabhupada set the example and left Vrindavan. Why? Everyone knows the answer. Why? For preaching. Now, in my mind, and from also my experience, because I lived in Vrindavan for 13 years, and then I lived in Australia, that if you're not preaching and not doing deity worship and not reading the Bhagavatam and not doing fully engaged in service living in the West, it's very, very, very draining, or anywhere. But especially in the West, the materialistic place. It pulls you, just like Vrindavan pulls you towards Krishna, and Mayapur pulls you to Krishna. Just naturally, you walk around and everyone says, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Prabhu, come. Hare Krishna, come. But everything is connected to Krishna. In the West, everything is connected to Maya. So it's very important, from my experience and from my studies also, that if one is not in Vrindavan and Mayapur, where the atmosphere really does support one, one better preach. And one, if one's not going to preach, one better support the preaching. And that has to be one's mentality. Otherwise, it's very, very difficult and very draining. Draining means it takes one's spiritual energy and spiritual impetus. It pulls it and it crushes it. And lots of kirtan is required. One needs these sarup siddhi bhakti forms. One needs to be make sure one is saturated. And if one thinks, oh, everywhere is the same as Mayapur and Vrindavan, I don't need to do this, then one might be very casual. One should know that the real reason to be outside of these holy places is to preach and somehow be very fully serving Krishna. Otherwise, it's quite dangerous. Yes, that was what I wanted to say. Now, in the last three verses of the ladies' words and their conversation, they're going to talk about the queens of Dwarka and how fortunate they are. these queens who is wonderful, the queens of Dwarka, there are 16,108 of them, and their position is so wonderful. And we're hearing about them in this chapter and how wonderful they are. And in the next chapter, we will see them. And this will be the last glimpse of Krishna that we are going to get, his dealings with these queens. And here is our introduction to them. And this is what the ladies on top of the roof say. They said how glorious the Yadu dynasty is because Krishna has taken his birth within it. How glorious is Mathura, how glorious is Dwarka, and how glorious are Krishna's wives, the queens of Dwarka, because of their intimate dealings. Now listen to this. There's something very interesting in this. There's a mention of the gopis and a mention of the queens. Who is being glorified in the verse? The queens. And it looks like the gopis are less fortunate than the queens. But actually, see what the verse is saying. Oh friends, just think of his wives, whose hands he has accepted, how they must have undergone vows, baths, fire sacrifices, and perfect worship of the Lord of the universe to constantly relish now, the nectar from his lips by kissing. The damsels of Brajabhumi would often faint just by expecting such favors. See what it is saying, how these queens are so fortunate that they're able to kiss, they're Krishna's wives, they're able to kiss him so many times. And that favor, if the gopis even thought about that, they would faint. So in glorifying the position of the queens and expressing their fortune, actually the supreme fortune of the gopis is brings. That just what to speak of actually as husband and wife kissing Krishna, but just the thought of that happening, the gopis would faint. What an incredible position of love for Krishna they occupy. This is the hint of why Bhishma Dev glorified them right before he left, remembered the gopis, the most exalted of Krishna's devotees, who would faint just thinking about meeting Krishna in a lonely place. What a position the gopis occupy with of love for Krishna. But the queens of Dwarka, Krishna's 16,108 queens, are so wonderful. I'll read the three verses and then we'll read from some of the purports. Just think of his wives. So the ladies are thinking, because they're ladies and they're thinking, just like one time your Guru Maharaj, he was in Bangladesh and he was taking a bath in one pukur there. He was bathing there. And there was some, and because he was so big and strong, he heard some Bengali Matajis walking by, some old ladies. And they looked at him, sadhu. And they said, oh, how fortunate his mother must be to have a son like this. In Bengali, they didn't know he could understand. That's the way Bengali Matajis think. How fortunate his mother must be. So the queens, or the ladies upon the roofs, they're thinking, oh, because they're Matajis, they're thinking, oh, how fortunate are the queens of Dwarka. They must have undergone vows, bathed, fire sacrifices, perfect worship of the Lord of the universe, to be able to relish now the nectar of his lips. They're so fortunate, that which they are getting The gopis of Vrindavan, just thinking about it, they'll faint. The children of these ladies are Prajumna, Samba, Amba, etc. Ladies like Rukmini, Satyabhama, and Jambavati were forcibly taken away by him from their Swayamvara ceremony after he defeated many powerful kings headed by Shishupal. Because when these Kshatriya ladies, when they would gain their husband by him defeating so many people, thereby showing his power, their love for him and their servitude for him would increase and increase and increase. And other ladies were also forcibly taken away by him after he killed Bhumasura, so many, and thousands of his assistants. All of these ladies are glorious. All these women auspiciously glorify their lives despite their being without individuality and without purity. Their husband, the lotus-eyed personality of Godhead, never left them alone at home. He always pleased their hearts by making valuable presentations. So how fortunate these ladies, these queens are, because they're always with Krishna and he's always with them. And he's leaving us now. So this is the expression of their love. Now we'll read some of Prabhupada's purports. 228. Attainment of this stage of pure spiritual life is the highest perfection. This is just after the first sentence. And this stage is called Swarup, or the factual identity of the living being. Liberation means renovation of this stage of Swarup. In that perfect stage of Swarup, the living being is established in five phases of loving service, one of which is the stage of Madhurjaras, or the humor of conjugal love. The Lord is always perfect in himself, and thus he has no hankering for himself. He, however, becomes a master, a friend, a son, or a husband, to fulfill the intense love of the devotee concerned. Herein, two classes of devotees of the Lord are mentioned in the stage of conjugal love. One is Swakya and the other is Parakya. Both of them are in conjugal love with the personality of Godhead Krishna. The queens at Dwarka were Swakya, or duly married wives, but the damsels of Braja were young friends of the Lord while he was unmarried. The Lord stayed at Vrindavan till the age of 16, and his friendly relations with the neighboring girls were in the term of Parakya. These girls, as well as the queens, underwent severe penances by taking vows, bathing, and offering sacrifices in the fire as prescribed in the scriptures. The rites, as they are not an end in themselves, nor a fruit of actions, culture of knowledge, or perfection in mystic powers ends in themselves. They are all meant to attain to the highest stage of Swarup, to render constitutional transcendental service to the Lord. Each and every living being has his individual position in one of the above-mentioned five different kinds of reciprocating means with the Lord, and in one's pure spiritual form of Swarup, the relationship becomes manifest without mundane affinity. The kissing of the Lord, either by his wives or his young girlfriends who aspire to have the Lord as their fiancé, is not of any mundane, perverted quality. Had such things been mundane, a liberated soul like Sukadev would not have taken the trouble to relish them, nor would Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu have been inclined to participate in those subjects after renouncing worldly life. The stage is earned after many lives of penance. And at the end of the purport of 29, there were 16,100 beautiful girls who were daughters of many kings and were forcibly stolen by Bhumasura, who kept them captive for his carnal desire. These girls prayed piteously to Lord Krishna for their deliverance, and the merciful Lord, called by their fervent prayer, released them all by fighting and killing Bhumasura. Now, I find in here there are some interesting points for us who are held captive by Maya. There are some very good instructions in here. These girls prayed piteously to the Lord for their deliverance. And the merciful Lord, called by their fervent prayer, released them all. How? By fighting and killing Bhomasura. All these captive princesses were then accepted by the Lord as his wives. Although in the estimation of society, they were all fallen girls. So Krishna overlooked their impure state due to being with Bhomasura. Why? Because of the depth of their piteous prayers, fervent prayers. The all-powerful Lord Krishna accepted the humble prayers of these girls and married them with the adoration of queens. So altogether, Lord Krishna had 16,108 queens of Dwarka, and in each of them he begot 10 children. All these children grew up, and each had as many children as the father. The aggregate of the family numbered in the millions. And a bit of the purport in text 30. The fallen girls under the clutches of Bhomasura sincerely prayed to Lord Sri Krishna for their deliverance. And their sincerity of purpose made them at once pure by virtue of devotion. The Lord therefore accepted them as his wives, and thus their lives became glorified. Such auspicious glorification was still more glorified when the Lord played with them as the most devout husband. So that's the end of their words. The last words have to do with the queens of Dwarka. We will see. We will actually meet them and watch them for a short while at the end of the next chapter. While the ladies of the capital of Hastinapur were greeting him and talking in this way, the Lord, smiling, accepted their good greetings, and casting the grace of his glance over them, he departed from their city. Maharaj Yudhisthira, although no one's enemy, engaged 4 divisions of defense, horses, elephants, chariot, and army, to accompany Lord Krishna, the enemy of the Asuras, the demons. The Maharaj did this because of the enemy and also out of affection for the Lord. So he went to protect Krishna, but he wanted to be with him. So he left the city with all his armies. Out of profound affection for Lord Krishna, the Pandavas, who were of the Kuru dynasty, accompanied him a considerable distance to see him off. The Lord, however, persuaded them to return home, and he proceeded towards Dwarka with his dear companions. O Shonaka, the Lord then proceeded towards Kuru Jungle, Panchal, Surasena, the land on the bank of the river Jamuna, Brahmavarta, Kuru Chetra, Matsya, Saraswata, the province of the desert, and the land of scanty water. After crossing these provinces, he gradually reached the Sorvir and the Abhir provinces. Then west of these, he reached Dwarka at last. On his journey through these provinces, he was welcomed, worshipped, and given various presentations. In the evening, in all places, the Lord suspended his journey to perform evening rites. This was regularly observed after sunset. So all done by Krishna, everything that Krishna does is good for everyone. He sets the example, but we cannot imitate him. And everything he does is wonderful. So, what to do? You have 3 minutes worth of questions? So the impression that I see is being built up in the Bhagavatam here is that we want to develop our relationship with Krishna. We have to become attracted to him. Yes. When it conflicts with his instructions, we follow the instructions, not the When it conflicts with his instructions, we follow the instructions, not his example. any other question?
An observation.
Or, yes, absolutely. Yes. Because Krishna lived in Vrindavan, he lived in Mathura, he lived in Dwarka, and he visited Hastinapur. I think Gopal Krishna Maharaj has been preaching to you. He said that since the devotees of the Lord are more important than even the Lord, and Krishna also went to Hastinapur, why isn't Hastinapur, the home of the Pandavas, considered a holy dham also? Huh? But it is considered within a holy, very holy area. It is, definitely. Not Mathura, but the greater one, the next one, where Krishna walked from here and there and there. Certainly it's holy. All of Bharat is holy. But there, those are dhams that descend from the spiritual world. I've never heard that Hastinapur descends from the spiritual world. But maybe, I don't know. Huh? Oh, yes. Because the question is, why is Dwarka Puri, Jagannath Puri, but what is Vrindavan? Is this Vrindavan? Yes. It's a forest. Hastinapur, Puri, Hastinapuri. Huh? I'm not able to hear. Just, yes. 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 Well, we know that nothing is lost in Krishna consciousness. So at the time of death, when we leave the body, we do our best to prepare for that time in our life. But at the end, we don't know what's going to happen to us, how we'll be able to deal with the difficulties of the circumstances. So we're forced to ultimately rely on Krishna and mercy at those times. So our limitations can be overcome by the mercy of Srila Prabhupada, by the mercy of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Krishna. Because Krishna has also promised that he carries what we lack. It is not that someone can serve Krishna so sincerely his whole life and then something happens at the time of death and Krishna says, well, he didn't think of me, you know. Sorry, you know, these are the rules right there in the Bhagavad Gita. It says, you know, whatever you think of, and, you know, sorry. But he's God also, and he's also full of compassion. And he carries what we have, he brings to us what we lack. So we try our best, but ultimately we have to depend on Krishna, because our best is insignificant compared to the power of the material energy. So that's the actual practice of life, is depending on Krishna, trying our best and depending on Krishna. And that prepares us for the time when we leave this world as best we are able. And then there's the mercy of Krishna and Mahaprabhu and... Yes. Hmm. Nectar of instruction. Well, despite us. Yeah, how could the master forget a sincere servant?